This is Voyager Revisited, a podcast dedicated to the Star Trek Voyager series. I'm Jean McDonald, and on each episode, I invite a Star Trek fan on to talk about Voyager. For this episode, my guest is Moises Chuyan, who is one of my podcast brothers at The Incomparable, and an amazing fount of knowledge on all the things. Moises, seriously, welcome to Voyager Revisited.
I need to hire you as my hype woman, because I need that level of salesmanship, telling people that, yes, in this gig economy, you need him for this random gig.
Yes.
Because he knows all the things. So saith Gene McDonald. I'm going to quote you on that. I'm going to put it on billboards.
Excellent. That's seriously.
Skywrite it.
You and I have been on several, or many, I don't know what the cutoff is, but we are often finding ourselves together on a panel at The Incomparable on various stories, whether they are sci-fi or comic book based or shark based. I don't know if you were on the Jaws one, but we've definitely talked about a lot of movies.
I lose track. I don't remember if I, at this point, I think I was on the Jaws episode, because I usually, I try to weasel my way into the old movie clubs, no matter what movie it is. And if I wasn't on the Jaws episode, it would have felt like I was, because now when I listen to the show, I have to remind myself whether or not I was actually on one or not. And sometimes I will find myself listening to an episode from a year and a half ago that I forgot that I was on. But The Incomparable is such a family of podcasting crew, aeronauts of the podcasting skies.
Yes.
Even when you're not on, you feel like you're part of the family, you're part of the crew.
Yes. No, definitely. Anyway, I am not joking about Moises's knowledge of all the things, because I never fail to be impressed at his deep knowledge and understanding of pretty much any subject that we are talking about. So,
well, look, I'll say this: growing up the son of a graduate school professor, you learn how to fake it really well.
Yes.
So I don't know how much I actually know about much of anything, but I know how to sound like I really know what I'm talking about, and I know how to cram for something in 30 minutes like nobody's business. So thank you, Gene. That is far, far, far too kind. I should thank you for motivating me to I haven't gotten to it yet, but I've moved up a proper watch through of Voyager on my stuff to watch list because of your fervent, passionate advocacy for the show. A show that I think, for me, I did not latch onto because Deep Space Nine was taking a lot out of me. And next, they had one show after another, and Voyager came on, and the first episode was interesting, and it kind of lost me in the first season, and I went, I've still got Deep Space Nine, I'm good. let me know when it gets crazy, when it picks up. And then I went to college right around the time it started to really pick up for the people who really were watching it as it broadcast and fervently were behind it. But because of your lovely show, and in this world of everybody having easy access to stuff, that, doesn't cost $150 a DVD set. I feel like there will be more people like myself, that are venturing out into the Delta Quadrant, to look at this, this great stuff that you just keep beating the drum for.
Yeah, I can't help it. I have always liked Star Trek a lot, ever since I was a little kid, but I was in graduate school during the Next Generation run. So, also known as the years of no TV. And, and I knew Voyager was coming out, but I didn't really see it when it was first on. And then, but with Netflix, I'm sure it was Netflix, I was stuck at home ill one time, and I'm like, oh yeah, there's that other Star Trek show I was interested in. Let's have a look. And I couldn't stop watching. And the beauty of it at the time for me was I was just a Star Trek fan off on my own. I didn't participate in any kind of, fandom discussions. There wasn't, I don't think Twitter was even on back then, and I wasn't on Facebook. So, you know, it was just like, hey, I'm watching the show and I like it. And I didn't tell anybody, hey, you got to watch the show. I just was like, thank you, Star Trek, for.
But now you're out there ringing those Vulcan bells in the corner, you know, asking for people to put their views in the bucket.
Yes.
Is this the part of Voyager Revisited where I tell you when I started watching Star Trek?
Yes, exactly that part.
Am I a good enough fan of the show?
I love, yes, you are.
Myself.
I love having on what I call the auto guest, where now I just go and make a cup of coffee while Moises continues the podcast because he knows it well, and I know that he can do that.
make your cup of coffee like Captain Janeway.
Yes. Yes.
Well, my reduced Star Trek origin story. I've told, I think, versions of this on Random Trek, which I've been on a few times. I started watching Star Trek. It was in syndication. It was TNG that was on. When I was younger, I won't say how much younger. I like people being mystified by how old I actually am, because I drop Ernie Kovacs and Johnny Carson references all the time.
Yes.
So people are like, "Are you 20, 45? Or how old are you?"
Yes.
So I was watching The Next Generation. And it seemed like my kind of thing. I think TOS was also on in reruns and syndication, whether it was on UPN or the Paramount station or whatever it was called at the time. My autistic little brother liked these shows that were constantly on in rotation, and there was some cable channel that would have 4 hours of it on at a time. He was young enough that he was not yet in school, and so he spent a lot of time in front of a TV. And he liked this Star Trek show that occasionally had space battles and acting with a capital A and italics and an underline, you know, some theatrical flair to it. He dug it. And when he and I would have interests that intersected, it would be beneficial to me because I was kind of his default babysitter. And so watching Star Trek with him, it didn't matter what episode it was. It didn't matter if I had seen it three times. If you wanted to own it, you had to go to Suncoast Motion Picture Company, where they had a wall size display of Star Trek The Next Generation tapes with one episode per tape.
Wow.
That cost, I don't know, $25 a pop. And when I saved up and got to buy my first one of those, my brother got to make the choice, and it was Skin of Evil. Spoilers for a 20 plus year old episode of TNG where Tasha Yar dies.
That's terrible.
I have seen Skin of Evil so many times because that was one of the things he would fixate on, was he would play and replay and rewind and play the same scenes, three line interchanges. I know so many parts of so many movies and TV shows incredibly well because I was Ludovico techniqued, like in Clockwork Orange, without all the problematic stuff, but just on nerd stuff like this. And so I'm really glad that I liked Star Trek because I got fed a very steady diet of, in some cases, whatever episodes they were running. I came to TNG after it was already going, but they were rerunning the early season episodes chronologically, I think on Saturday or Sunday afternoons or something. And then the new episode was that Sunday night. I forget exactly how it worked out, but I was kind of getting caught up while I was contemporaneously watching, I want to say it was the third season of that show. And so it was my first series that I followed sequentially. But as I've said on Random Trek, you know, and as is still controversial among many Star Trek fans, Deep Space Nine is really what made me a lifer when it came to Star Trek storytelling and mythos, and especially when they went serialized in the late stages of the show. That was evolving Star Trek for the actual next generation of fans. In a way that, I mean, that's what all TV is now, is the sequential serialized kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a good point.
And it, the bits of Voyager that I've dipped back into, I'm looking at it going, oh, they were trying to not do what Deep Space Nine was doing. And if they had used the raw materials they had, the components they had with Voyager, and embraced that, the shows, as many great things as the show accomplished, I feel like they would have better served the cast that they had. And I have to admit, you know, speaking from, I have not watched all seven seasons, but I've watched healthy chunks of it now, where as I dip back into, you know, the season one, season two stuff, I'm like, oh boy, this is a lot of Kazon. This is a lot of store brand Klingons. This, like, you know, the store was all out of Klingons. All they have is the store brand of the Klingons. And that's what we're getting a whole lot of. And the episode in particular that I'm on to discuss, one that made me question, wait a minute, I thought I hated Neelix. Neelix is pretty good in this episode.
He is good in this episode.
What? Yeah, I mean, it makes me wonder.
I'm not going to say that you're wrong about your original opinion, but every once in a while, there's like great stuff written for Neelix, and this is, I forgot, you know, totally that this is one of those episodes.
You know, a broken clock is right twice a day. so maybe it's one of those.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I like the optimistic notion of the future, couched with the fact that, you know, part of my worldview, I think, is very heavily influenced by Star Trek, despite what Gene Roddenberry's ghost might have to say about it, which is that I think that having an optimistic footing about life, you know, with one foot in the pragmatic realist, pool, is a good way to push back against the ever encroaching notion of fascism and totalitarianism and so on, which is something that, you know, my dad was a Cuban refugee. That is part of my background. That is part of my life. It was something that I did not have, a lot of kids that could relate. I had one Iranian friend whose family fled the Iranian Revolution in the late '70s in school. And so, we didn't even realize that we could relate to each other on that wavelength until many, many years later. But I looked at something like Star Trek telling these stories metaphorically in some ways that have not aged terribly well over 20 or 30 years.
no, they
but
have not.
Star Trek was making an effort when nobody else was.
Yes.
And doing things like the Twilight Zone did in its original run. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, long-winded love letter, to one of my favorite intellectual property franchises out there. But yeah, as a Deep Space Nine fan, I'm so glad that you blessed me with the episode I had forgotten that Aaron Eisenberg was on.
Yes. Well, I thought you would be interested in that because I knew you were a Deep Space Nine fan. And, when Aaron Eisenberg passed away, I mean, I've seen all of Deep Space Nine, but it was later. Like I watched Voyager before Deep Space Nine. I'd seen a few Deep Space Nine episodes, from the first like season or so. And I thought, I'm sorry, I want my people to be on a ship, like traveling around this base station feels very depressing and claustrophobic and dark.
Star Trek diplomacy. It's like Star Trek characters playing the game diplomacy, which doesn't make for the most thrilling television, depending on how you're doing it. And then they got a warship that cloaks and everything was fine.
Right. It was, so I basically, you know, I watched a few episodes and, you know, it's Star Trek. So I was like mildly interested, but I was also not really, I wasn't really drawn to it until I got to know Scott McNulty, our mutual friend and the host of Random Trek, who also is the Deep Space Nine, you know, fan. And he's the first person I knew who was so passionate about it. And I thought, again, another illness, you know, helpfully, it, you know, came along and I was stuck in bed and I'm like, Well, just start watching Deep Space Nine. Apparently, it gets more interesting in season three. And then
it
I was
sure
like,
does.
Was like, oh, okay. Now this is not what I was not what I was expecting. And then, of course, you have to watch the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, the defining thing about what we all call the TNG era is that all three of those shows, TNG, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager, all followed a pattern of, well, they found their way by around season three.
Yeah.
Season three, they shook the thing down. They figured out where they were going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but once we get to about season three of Voyager, we blissfully have so much less Kazon to deal with.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, yeah, the Kazon are problematic. And there's many problematic aspects of that episode.
We could do a whole podcast
about what is
I'm
wrong.
I'm sure people have.
What is wrong with the Kazon? What's wrong with Chakotay? And yes, and I would like to touch on those subjects. But I do think that I do want to say that one of the things that's nice for me about Voyager is that because it is still in the old-fashioned episodic, mm-hmm. you know, we forget everything at the beginning of the next episode kind of thing, is that I can just jump around and have like whole stories told yeah. and finished. And it makes it, you know, something I go back to, whereas I have never really gone back to Deep Space Nine because I know if I start anywhere in the middle of some arc, I will just finish the whole arc.
And this is Admiral Who, and what's he doing? Oh, God, I've watched seven episodes of this. What have I done?
But, you know, that's true. That's true about any TV show now, like with so much stuff that comes out, you know, with all the episodes, you know, are released simultaneously. And it is, you know, it's an integrated story. I know I don't even start episode one unless I have some downtime because I have no willpower. I will watch the whole thing. So
for me, the thing that as I've dipped into Voyager, and this episode's actually season two, episode two, mm-hmm. Initiations.
Yes.
It's a great example of that I really love in stark contrast to TNG, where Dr. Crusher could not keep a patient alive to save her life. Like she was just written into this corner of being the least competent, ultra competent doctor in Starfleet, apparently. But I think part of that was because of who was running that show. In stark contrast to that, in the early stages of TNG, Voyager, we have a very diverse, strong female led crew.
Yes.
Who are all super competent, super with it, super on top of their game.
Yes.
And really, really doing the show proud.
Yes.
I love super competent people in space.
Even Neelix. Neelix.
For whom the vacuum of space magically does not make them suddenly incompetent for the sake of narrative convenience. I love that. I love it. These people are supposed to be super great at their jobs. That's why they're in space with a giant ship that could, you know, blow a hole in a planet. So, hey, it's great. It's great when they are what's actually printed on the label. For me, one of the things that interested me about Voyager was the representation of not just but multiple Latino crew members.
Yeah.
One of whom was very specifically in Chakotay's case cast as the Central American vague tribe native, you know, First Peoples descent guy, who seems to be followed around all throughout the Delta Quadrant by a little woodwind flute bit of music that just would chime in for a spirit quest here,
yeah,
or you know something else there. They hired a consultant. I'm sure they hired a guy at the beginning of the show.
They did,
but again, there are probably dissertations written about how they didn't. This room full of white writers did not do such a great job.
Well,
of accurately representing things going throughout the series. To this day, this is the most prominent instance of a Native American portrayal on a science fiction show.
It's true.
Period.
But so, still, do you know the story of their consultant? Turned out it was a total charlatan. and he didn't know stuff. So
wait a minute, you're
no,
you're kidding
I am
me.
Not kidding you. Shoot, I wish I had the name of the guy up handy here, but yes, this is a well-known established thing that they hired somebody who really did not know and who steered them wrong. So, I mean, I'm not saying that they would have done this amazing job otherwise, because there's definitely other stuff. Like, I did some deeper reading on this whole, you know, Native American representation in Star Trek, you know, in to prepare for this episode. But, and so there are other things that were problematic that no consultant could have helped. But
yeah,
they
the biggest problem, it was 1995.
Yeah.
To say that things were not in the best shape in 1995 in Hollywood, to do proper representation of a people, you know, that's not a big stretch.
Nah. So yeah, so I do think that yes, I think that Chakotay, I mean, and he is of, you know, Mexican descent, even though he's not. Of the traditional, like, on TV Native American tribes that are often represented, but poorly, let's, you know, but still.
Yeah. There's a difference, you know, there's an ethnic difference between people who identify with verified, you know, Mayan, Aztec, mm-hmm. You know, Mixtec, a variety of different, extractions from tribal peoples.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was no charlatan on that front.
No,
as
that's true.
You know, as the actor, like their consultant was.
Yes.
So you know, they constantly had him doing this vaguely native stuff that I was like, this feels like it's from like an episode of Green Acres. right. Okay. All right, cool. Can we get away from the woodwind flute and let the guy just do his job?
Yeah.
You know, maybe we can dig into that whole, you know, McKee crew integrating with the Starfleet crew thing. Oh, no, you don't?
No.
You want to do another spirit quest? Okay. All right.
Another spirit.
Cool.
Yeah, there's a few too many of those like vague spirit quests and the
he's practically a Native American proselytizer, where I've lost track of how many times Chakotay is just trying to preach the good word of the tribe that isn't named or explained until many seasons into the show.
Yeah, and Janeway does a spirit something, Torres, Tuvok, I'm pretty sure, like, you know, definitely they did it poorly, but as you say, it's still the only, you know, at least attempt to do something different and show, you know, with a major character. Yeah. I mean, he's number two on this ship, and he's an awesome character. Like, if you take away that stuff that's cringy, I love Chakotay. Like, I love.
Yeah. For what they let him do, and I feel like I can say that about most of the cast of Voyager, where everybody got some real juicy stuff to do, and then it's like the show forgets about them for entire seasons at a time.
Yep.
And he gets more shortchanged toward the end of the show, like a lot of the cast.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of staggering, because there's so much good stuff. Mm-hmm. Throughout the show's run.
Yeah.
I like that he's on the show. I like that he's there and showing up. And, you know, in those days, you did what scripts they gave you, and they weren't going to do a page one rewrite on something, because, you know, Paramount was a factory at that point.
Yeah.
Making sometimes 25 episodes of this stuff a year.
Yes. And I think, like, you know, just going back to the general topic of, like, Voyager really did bring a new look to a crew that, you know, bringing in these different kinds of characters. And, you know, certainly Torres is one of my favorites as well. And
yeah, Torres is amazing. I think I'm one of the few Harry Kim defenders,
and
it's from a certain point of view too.
Yeah.
In that, when they gave him something worth doing. Great. Like,
yeah,
Garrett Wong had no control whatsoever over the corners they wrote him into. And there's stuff in the show that, again, this is probably a whole other episode of your show, but there is stuff that looks patently like vindictive stuff from some writer who did not like the fact that this guy who's just an ensign on the show was like, hey, give me more to do. And some of the writing feels vindictive. It feels emasculating. It feels,
yeah,
it feels like, you know, look, the white people who ran Paramount at the time,
yeah,
as progressive as Star Trek as a property is known for being, that does not mean that it doesn't have its share of problems too. And it's stuff that he's been more public about in recent years, about what the environment was like on that set for him,
mm-hmm,
where he was on the show and they just, you know, the worst thing you could do would be ask for more to do.
Hmm.
And catching the wrong writer or the wrong executive producer in the wrong mood. And I feel like he's a victim of that. I feel like, you know, Seven was able to overcome some of the, hey, we're going to just, you know, we need to spice up the show.
Yeah.
Was where I think the producers are coming from. And then the writers wrote her into the character that everybody loves, so deeply now and is so iconic and, mm-hmm, indivisible from the show at this point.
Correct.
The thing that I find fascinating is that in my memory, the swatches of episodes that I saw from the first two seasons, none of them felt like they were as good as this one, which is literally the second episode of season two.
Yeah.
Which, in some ways they're doing Darmok over again, sort of, kind of. It's enemy mine in different clothes a little bit. You know, in terms of the plot,
yeah,
there's a little bit of stuff that they've done it 12 times in different ways. You know, all right, which senior staff member are we going to strand on a planet with somebody who's got latex all over their face? And
true.
Honestly, there's some of the kind of de rigueur stuff that I was kind of expecting of, oh, Chakotay's, you know, on a shuttle six on a spirit quest 6 hours away from Voyager. God knows why he had to be that far out,
right,
for his ritual to work or something.
I mean,
maybe he just liked a particular nebula or star cluster.
Maybe the holodeck. I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, one place in the vacuum of space would seem to be, good enough, yeah, for another. But look, then the episode wouldn't exist.
No, and exactly. Where would we be? Yeah, then? We can't really ever go too far into that line of questioning. But yeah,
he's honoring his father.
Yes.
With this ritual. And the plot of the episode is him taking on a surrogate father role for our boy, Aaron Eisenberg, our 26-year-old child.
Yes.
He was 26 when they made this.
Yeah.
And, he looks about 13. And this is something that, you know,
he was good at this.
He was good at, it was part of his life. He embraced it. And I gotta be honest, not just because of the proximity to Aaron's death. I didn't know him. I never met him. I only knew him by reputation as apparently one of the sweetest, kindest people on the Trek circuit. And that's really saying something.
Yeah.
But he really acts the hell out of this.
I agree.
Touching.
This, the episode that I had suggested we would enjoy talking about, one, because, you know, we have a lot of feelings about the various, representation issues on Voyager. And this episode definitely touches on those. I didn't think about Talaxian representation until you brought it up. In fact, Neelix even, you know, turns out well in this one, but
I honestly now I worry about, you know, dipping into some of these episodes from the first few seasons that I haven't seen that will then turn me right back around on Neelix, where I'm like, where is the Neelix of season two, episode two? Give me that guy again.
Well,
I'm worried based on what well-trod Voyager fans tell me.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm looking for. Ethan Phillips is an amazing actor.
That's,
so,
yes.
You know, everybody could be wrong.
Yes. Everybody could be wrong, or everybody has their own opinion, is like, Scott McNulty said to me, this may blow your mind, but you can have that opinion and it can be right. However, the show is called Voyager Revisited for this reason. And the funny thing for me is it works on me too, because episodes that I thought were okay, I come around and go like, oh, there were these really good parts, or this was really good. And Initiations is one of those. I haven't watched it in ages. Season 2, episode 2. And I hate it. Probably half of season 1, I think, is not that great. And I encourage people to skip a lot of episodes in season 1 as part of my Voyager viewing guide. But this one on my list was a skip. And now I'm thinking about upgrading it because, first of all, it is actually really the first important Kazon episode. I mean, the first really important one maybe is the pilot, because the Kazon, you know, are part of the mix of that, you know, the conflict with the caretaker and the crew and the Ocampa and the Kazon. But you don't really get to see the Kazon as anything really more than a bunch of thugs. And here, they are still quite thuggish, but you have this character of Carr that played by Aaron Eisenberg, plus this time spent on a Kazon ship. That is all new stuff. I didn't realize until rewatching it that they hadn't really gotten into the Kazon storyline until this episode. And so I think,
I mean, it's Voyager. I mean, you're going to end up watching Kazon episodes at some point. You might as well watch a good one.
And I'm starting to feel like it's not really skippable, because if you're going to watch Kazon episodes, you should probably start with the one that explains quite a lot about how the Kazon are organized and what their culture is like, such that it is. But yeah, and so this one, I liked it a lot. Another reason I liked it a lot is it's a very classic Trek setup of person, you know, out in space or on the surface in danger, and competent crew on the ship trying to save them. And that's the whole episode, is back and forth between those two. There's not a B plot there's just Chakotay and Carr, the Kazon, you know, youth that wants to prove his manhood by killing Chakotay and can't manage to do that. So I think that I just enjoyed it from that point of view. You know, Janeway is totally great. And the only thing that didn't really sit right with me is that because Janeway, Tuvok, and Chakotay are now, they leave the ship to go to the surface of this moon. Tom Paris is in charge? I don't know.
Balana's got to be down in engineering, right? Yeah. Pick your Maquis that you're going to put in charge.
Yeah.
But yeah, the moment she said, you know, Neelix, you want more to do, you can join Mr. Paris on the bridge. I went, oh no. And then it was fine.
It was great.
And then I should have trusted Captain Janeway. In Janeway we trust.
Yeah.
You know, it all worked out. I mean, precisely fine. It plays as a Star Trek episode, meat replacement and potatoes Star Trek episode. It's got the themes of you know, the concept of adulthood and honor and fulfillment and philosophy and peace and finding a better way. It is classical Star Trek and. There's not a bit of it that makes me feel weird, other than some of the, you know, basic stuff of, well, it was 1995.
Yeah.
You're going to have your store brand Klingons that are based on LA riot gangs, written by white people. And that's just, you know, that's the state of network television in the mid-90s. But they could have been way more offensive. Yes, they really could have. The Kazon really could have been way more offensive. Mm-hmm. And, if you don't know the backstory of where they took their inspiration from, they just look like off-brand Klingons.
Right.
Plain and simple. You know, 18 different houses, you know, yeah. the house of Duras and the house of this and the house of that. Uh-huh. And it's just different terminology for the same general concept.
Very disorganized Klingons.
Under budgeted Klingons, we'll say. You know, Klingons looking for a cosign.
Yeah.
On that loan, just to get the ship out of Hawk for just a week, and they'll go raid some settlements or something.
And the backstory is that they were, quote, inspired by the idea of like making some take on Los Angeles gangs. And it's so, I mean, gangs should be insulted as well by these.
Yeah. Frankly, the fact that the Crips and the Bloods did not shut down production of the show speaks to their incredible patience with all of that LA nonsense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating because you look at that, you know, you read the history on it and you go, huh, so that was their inspiration. And you look at what's quote unquote on the page mm-hmm. and you're like, oh. So their intentions were really, really offensive, and the potential for it was really offensive, but at least in this episode, could have been a lot worse. Again, yeah. it's like underfunded Klingons, meet Ferengi and the original iteration of Ferengi where they have laser whips and stuff. You know, it just, you know, they have to have a transporter stolen for them because they can't steal one on their own.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah.
Yeah.
It could have been worse. It could have been so much worse. No,
and I think.
And in fact, going back, I thought it was going to be a lot worse. And then I went, oh, this is it? Okay, fine.
Yeah. I couldn't remember how it wrapped up. I knew there was a twist, but I was like, first of all, I did like seeing Chakotay on the Kazon ship as a prisoner who manages to like hijack the whole thing and take their leader hostage to escape from the ship. Like, that's because, yes, he talks a lot about not wanting to make enemies, but that doesn't mean he's a pushover. And that was pretty cool. And the fact that Carr went with him because, you know, that's the central dilemma for this one-off character is he, by not only not killing Chakotay, but having Chakotay save him from dying, his chance at being an honorable Kazon has been, you know, he has nothing to live for, right? He's just going to be this dishonored coward in the eyes of his people. So taking like a very stereotypical idea of honor among gangs or yeah. honor among tribes, right? Because, you know, that kind of manhood, you know, ritual stuff is also quite overused and used poorly, you know, in Native American representations as well. So you have, you know, Chakotay. The fact that Chakotay and Carr can have like, I thought, you know, really interesting interaction on that moon about, you know, that feeling of trust, you know, definitely the Darmok / you know, enemy mine of what's going to happen. There's the only two and they're alone. And, you know, he saved my life, you know, one time, you know, if you save it two more times, we'll be even because Chakotay has saved Carr's butt three times.
What? And the twist in the episode, I mean, it really is pretty 1995 progressive to let Carr take his agency back instead of the big, smart, you know, knows better, is better funded Federation guy, letting him direct the destiny of this guy.
That's right.
I loved that.
Yes, that was the twist. Because I did think, oh, yeah, he kills Chakotay, you know, momentarily, but then the doctor revives Chakotay, but Carr gets to say he killed Chakotay. No, that's not what happens. And, you know, he turns yeah. around and he kills the first Maj of this Kazon Ogla group. And I was like, oh man, I totally forgot that he did that. And so that is a good thing because I have to say, part of me was like, man, it would have been interesting to have like Kazon teenager on Voyager. Like, you know, that was one option, take him with. And not that he wanted to go. And he said, you know, rightfully so, like what the further you get closer to your home, the further away we are from mine. But I thought, what would it have looked like to have a Kazan? You know, well, the ridiculous hair and everything would have lasted the whole series, and that would have been annoying. But
yeah, and you know, he was then on
Deep Space Nine, right? There was no way he could continue that role.
Yeah, it was probably, you know, Aaron was like, hey, guys, give me something else to do. Nog isn't in like 8 episodes of this. Mm-hmm. And they went, well, do you want to put on another latex mask and go across the street?
Yeah.
I mean, that's my assumption.
No, actually.
The backstory of this.
No, actually, they tried to cast a teenager. And they just didn't find anybody who was, had like the acting chops for this role. And, you know, it was suggested that they consider Aaron. And so he auditioned for this and they chose him. It wasn't just go across the street and, you know, do Voyager for a day. And
it was, they go to the next soundstage over and go, hey, do you want to audition for this thing? And then he must've been like, am I getting killed off on Deep Space Nine? What's happening? Yeah. Oh no. Are you trying to like soften the blow?
Yeah.
You know, you imagine so many different stories.
It's
about that
interesting
because kind of
they're very different characters. And, I hadn't seen Deep Space Nine when I first saw this, so it didn't affect me at all, but, apparently there was some rumblings, you know, in the fandom that even though he looked quite different, obviously, people felt that they could still hear his voice in this. But I found it, I don't know, I even though I knew it was Aaron Eisenberg, I didn't feel like that. I didn't say like, oh, look, it's Nog with a wig. You know, at all.
Yeah, for me, it shows off his range.
Yeah.
It's a great example of what he was capable of. And especially when you're working under a latex mask on sci-fi shows, especially Star Trek in the 90s, you get typecast into this is the thing that you do. Mm-hmm. I mean, Michael Dorn, everybody loves him as Worf. Everybody knows him as Worf. And also he was on Gargoyles. And getting pigeonholed on a science fiction series is very easy to do and very hard to get out of, after the fact. But yeah, there are always those complaints of the time, and then you go forward enough years and, you know, the petty stuff, nobody thinks about it anymore. Something I was going to mention, as we were talking about the writing and how very classic Star Trek it is, but at the same time, how it kind of pushes the ball forward in ways that I don't think this show got enough credit for. The credited writer on the episode is Kenneth Biller, mm-hmm. who was on the show seasons 1 through 7, more episodes with a writing credit in season 1 and season 7 than the ones in between. But writing credits are notoriously misleading.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing on his resume, that I found taking a look at it this afternoon is he also wrote the Star Trek, the Klingon Encounter, interactive experience at the Star Trek Vegas, resort.
Huh.
And then, a credited co-writer on it, Lisa Klink, she did one episode of Deep Space Nine around this time, and then she was on Voyager between seasons 2 and 4 and wrote a bunch of stuff. And she wrote the Borg 4D interactive experience thing.
Hmm.
So they know the bones of Star Trek really well. And in the ways that they push the ball forward, I'm thankful for them.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to upgrade this to a definitely watch episode. I enjoyed it way more than I remembered. And I think that, it does have some important, first of all, if you're a Star Trek fan, you should see Aaron Eisenberg in a different Star Trek role. That's always fun. And the Kazan, just learning more about them, because you are going to have to live with them for a little while.
Please don't make me the Kazan apologist, because I'm not making you. All right.
I will be the Kazan apologist in the sense that it seems
There's
longer
some good stuff.
Than it
There's
really
some good
is.
Stuff in there. Yeah.
you remember especially. It as taking forever, but this is season 2, episode 2, And it's really one of the first ones where Kazan, our major character, and by season two finale is the episode Basics, which is where the Kazan, they hijack Voyager. They leave the crew on a planet and take the Voyager away. And it's the kind of the final, you know, hurrah of the Kazan. And so it was really only one short season, I'm just going to say. That they.
Well, so if you follow Gene McDonald's patented viewing method, why, you too can skip over the tough parts.
Yeah, no, that's true. But I did, you know, in my research for this episode, one of the funniest things I forgot about, because it's not mentioned in this episode, that's what, you know, this is only later when Seven of Nine is on, is we learn that the Kazan were the only species known to have been rejected by the Borg for assimilation. Species 329.
Well, that's an in-joke for you.
So it takes, I would think it, you know, takes a lot to be not even, you know, interesting to the Borg. You have to be pretty mediocre. So anyway, that's our episode, a little remembrance of Aaron Eisenberg, who was a fantastic character on Deep Space Nine and showed a different side of his acting chops here on Voyager. And he and Chakotay were very good. He and Robert Beltran, apparently they really, really enjoyed making this. They had a lot of fun.
You can tell. You can see it in the scene work. Like they are vibing perfectly.
Yeah. So I think it's an interesting episode for a lot of the characters. And then the Neelix as like swashbuckling guy on the bridge who bluffs the Kazans into backing off. I like that a lot.
Neelix Hornblower. You know?
Yeah.
Just taking the initiative.
Well, thanks, VoiceS, for taking the time to talk about this episode. I know we've been wanting to get together and do some Voyagering, and I'm glad we finally did it.
Anytime. I would love to be back whenever you'll have me.
Yeah, no, I'd like that, especially if you're going to, embark on Voyager rewatching, and want, you know, if you come across an episode that you get excited about and need to talk about it, you're always welcome on Voyager Revisited. And
I will.
Thanks, VoiceS, and thanks to the listeners for being here. You can find Voyager Revisited online at voyagercast.com. And you can follow us on Twitter and on micro.blog at @Voyager_cast. I will be back soon with another guest to discuss Star Trek Voyager. But until then, time's up.